So this morning, the text that we're going to be looking at invites us to explore what it means to have a posture of humility. All right? So before we jump in, why don't you take a minute and just with the neighbor next to you, chat about this question. Right? What comes to mind when you think about humility? Right? How would you define it? What does it mean to you? How does it look like? All right? What comes to mind when you think about humility? All right, I'll give you a moment to do that. All right. So, let's hear some of these. When you think about humility, so when that kind of, what kind of comes to the surface for you when you think about humility? Anyone? The opposite of ego? Okay, so the opposite of ego. So many thoughts. The opposite of Kanye. Okay. Openness. So humility as being open. Removing yourself from the center. What's that? Oh, Mr. Rogers. It's a great example. Great example. Humiliation. Yes. Act of grace. Oh, yeah. You know, for me, part of the challenge of growing up in an Asian culture was that we were taught never to draw attention to ourselves. And so we would always put on this facade of humility, right? To make people think that we were actually humble, when in reality, deep down inside, we just thought we were better than everyone else, right? And so there's sort of this, you know, false humility that plays out as well. But by definition, right, humility is just having a modest view of yourself or how important you think you are. And, you know, on the flip side, what we heard from some people too is the opposite, where you have arrogance or pride or ego, right, is having an elevated view or inflated view of yourself. And so humility then, at the core of it, really is about how you see yourself and others. Right, it's about whether the lens you use is actually helping you see yourself and others more clearly. Parker Palmer puts it this way. He says, humility is the only lens through which great things can be seen. And once we have seen them, humility is the only posture possible. Right, so how we see others and ourselves shapes our humility. And when we're in a posture of humility, it allows us to see things more clearly and for what they really are. And in some ways, we need to test our vision in order to gauge our humility. Back when I was in third or fourth grade, they would do the hearing and vision tests at school. I don't know if they still do that now. But I remember being extremely nervous. Right, I was thinking, you know, what if I don't hear all the frequencies, you know, they're playing in the headphones? Or what if I can't read all the letters on the poster? And so when I was in line, I was trying to get a sneak peek, and try to see what was on the poster. But it was too small and a little blurry, which only made me more worried. And so what I did was I listened really carefully to the kid in front of me and memorized all the letters he said. And then, boom, I aced it. But at that age, I didn't understand that cheating on a vision test actually isn't winning because I still can't see clearly. And so when I finally got glasses, right, I went to the optometrist. They put that massive contraption in front of your face, you know, where you look through, and they test out all these different combinations of lenses to see what's, you know, they ask you what's more clear. Is it one or two, two or three? Two or four, right? It's super stressful. But as a kid, it was an amazing experience to be able to see how different lenses would cause my vision to be amazingly clear or amazingly blurry. And so this morning, I want to invite us into an eye exam of sorts, right? To reflect on the types of lenses we use when we see ourselves, when we see others, when we see God. You know, if humility is about seeing ourselves more clearly and more authentically, then how might the lenses we use be helping or hurting our posture of humility? You know, the text we'll be looking at this morning, it might be familiar for some of us. It's a story that Jesus tells about a religious leader and a tax collector and how they see each other, how they see themselves. And at first glance, it can seem like a simple story, right? That the Pharisee is the villain, the tax collector is the hero, right? Maybe the takeaway is that we should all be more like the tax collector, we should be less like the Pharisee. But a lot of Jesus' stories were not that simple or black and white. And there was a lot more nuance, and I feel like that's something that we're invited to as we examine the different lenses we use to see others. And so we start in verse 9. And so Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And so, you know, Jesus introduces two contrasting characters in this story. Right, so there's this religious leader who is seen as someone of influence, someone of high standing. And then there's the tax collector who is seen as someone with much lower standing. Right? Because back in those days, tax collectors were seen as traitors. They were collecting taxes from their own people on behalf of the Roman Empire that was oppressing them. And there were no regulations around how much they could collect, and so they would end up collecting way more than they needed to pay the Romans, and all the extra they would keep as their personal bonus. And everyone knew that they were running this scam, but there was nothing they could do to stop it. And so there was motivation, there was cultural bias in viewing these tax collectors with contempt. And that's sort of the reason Jesus is telling this story, because he's trying to draw attention to the contempt that people and these religious leaders were having when they looked down on certain people. And for us, you know, humility invites us to acknowledge our own lens of contempt. Right? How is it that we devalue others in the way we see them? Because it's there for us all, right? Sometimes we're fully aware of it, other times we're not. Even with this story, right? By the end of it, maybe our reaction, our response is to see the Pharisee with contempt, and we end up being guilty of the same thing. And I get it, right? Sometimes we can rationalize, or maybe we view it as a form of justice to see someone with contempt because we feel like they deserve it. And so for us, if we dig a little deeper, right, if we really kind of scratch below the surface, who are the people that we see with contempt? Right? Take a moment, think about it. Like, who is the person that we look down upon? Or we see them as worthy of shame? And have an image of them in your mind. Right? Maybe it's someone who has different political beliefs. Maybe we have contempt towards certain people because of their life choices, because of their state of their relationships, maybe because of their preference of coffee versus tea. You know, for me, I'll admit that I have a difficult time with people who don't do the job they're supposed to be doing. And that can be people in politics, could be in our public education system, could be some of my coworkers, not the ones that I currently have, just to clarify, you guys are great. But back in my former life, when I was a technology consultant, there was one project that I was on, and we were brought on to do some government work for a state agency. And I ended up sharing offices with a government employee. And every morning I would come, show up, and then he would show up at least an hour later. And at first, I thought it was a joke, but later in the mornings, I would hear snoring. Like, just, yeah, loud snoring. And that would be the first of many naps that he would take that day. He was never prepared for meetings, he would leave work early. And so for me, I couldn't see any value in this person. Right? It was easy for me to have a lens of contempt towards him because I felt like he deserved it. But this is what Anthony DeMello says when it comes to people we have a difficult time with. He says, the finest act of love you can perform is not an act of service, but an act of seeing. When you serve people, you help, support, comfort, alleviate pain. When you see them in their inner beauty and goodness, you transform and you create. Because your dislike or your contempt had clouded your vision and prevented you from seeing. So he's saying that our contempt of certain people blinds us from being able to see them as someone created in the image of God. Right? Our choice to devalue them with our lens of contempt is fully in our own control. And he's saying that we have a gift to offer them. It has nothing to do with whether they change or whether they act differently. But we have the ability to transform them simply by the way we see them. Right? He goes on to say this. And in seeing them in this way, like when we see them with their inner beauty and goodness, it is an infinitely more loving gift that you offer them than any act of service. For in doing this, you have transformed them. You have created them in your heart. And given a certain amount of contact between you and them, they will be transformed in reality too. And so maybe for us, right? Something we can try is this practice of seeing without judgment. You know, this is how DeMello describes it. So first, right, think of someone that you see through a lens of contempt. Right? Whoever came to mind earlier. And then objectively observe what you dislike about them. You know, maybe it's their personality, maybe their work ethic, maybe their political views. And then consider how you might have been conditioned to dislike those things. You know, maybe it was your culture, maybe your upbringing that taught you to have contempt for those things. And then lastly, search for the treasures buried in this person that your contempt prevented you from seeing before. Because seeing them with judgment, seeing them without judgment, and seeing them with compassion instead of contempt has the ability to transform them. And then we continue in verse 11. So the Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income. So the Pharisee's prayer here is more like an announcement than an actual prayer. And, you know, one of the critiques of his prayer is that he's highlighting all the things that he's doing in order to earn God's favor. Right, so he's highlighting all his accomplishments. And to be fair, though, you know, fasting, tithing, those are meaningful spiritual practices. Like, he's doing the right things. And he's not wrong when he's expressing gratitude for the life he has, for the person he is. But the main issue that Jesus is trying to highlight here is that he thinks he's better than other people. And he's using his lens of comparison to isolate himself from others. Right? Even with him standing by himself, he's emphasizing this gap that somehow he's better and he has no desire to connect with this tax collector. And for us, right, humility invites us to examine our lens of comparison. Because, you know, when we compare ourselves with others, it can be either for the sake of competition, right, to be better than them, or it can be for the sake of curiosity, right, to connect with them. And what is it that we tend to focus on when we compare ourselves to others? You know, for me, I think it's the ability to be high-functioning, to work well under stress. Like, that's usually what I end up comparing myself and seeing and causing me to think that I'm better than other people. You know, maybe for some of us, it's moral behavior, like the Pharisee. Or maybe we compare our career or financial status. Or maybe it's our knowledge of film, music, pop culture. Or maybe it's we compare our social and political activism. Or maybe it's how well-read we are, right? Which kind of reminds me of this classic example from Portlandia. So check out the clip.
Oh, Maggie's running late.
Okay. Hey, did you guys read that thing in the New Yorker last month about how golf is an analogy for marriage?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did read that. Did you hear the thing at McSweeney's? Mm. I was comparing CD tracks and album tracks. Did you read that?
Yeah. Did you read that thing in Mother Jones about eco chairs and eco ways to sit?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Did you read that thing in Spin about all the festivals?
Did you read that thing in Pace? It was about the National.
Oh, I saw that. Did you see that thing in Dwell about all the mid-century houses?
Yeah. Did you read the New York Times?
Yes.
New York Observer?
Yes.
Washington Post?
Yes.
Wall Street Journal?
Of course I read it.
Did you read that steampunk article in Boing Boing?
I did not like the end of it.
Did you read that skywriting over the Willamette River?
Yes. Did you read the fortune cookie?
Yes.
From last night?
Yes.
Did you read it?
Yes.
There were two.
Yes. Did you read that thing that guy wrote in the sand on the beach?
Yeah.
Did you read the Portland Mercury?
Yeah.
Did you read the Willamette Week?
Yeah.
Did you read the Seattle Stranger?
Beginning to end.
Did you read the SF Weekly?
I loved it.
The Harvard Lampoon?
Well written.
Did you read Mad Magazine?
I did not like the end of it.
Did you read Kathy?
That was cute.
Did you read Family Circus?
Sure.
Did you read Calvin and Hobbes?
Sure.
Did you read The Boston Globe?
Sure.
Did you read The Washington Blade?
We read it together.
Did you read?
Uh-huh.
Did you read?
Mm-hmm.
Did you read?
Of course I did.
Did you read?
I read it to a friend of mine. Did you read the closing credits of that movie?
Yeah, did you read that book?
Did you read it?
Did you read the Bible?
Did you read it?
Did you read it?
Did you read it?
Finger writing on the window?
You did? Because I did.
Hey, Maggie.
Hey, Maggie.
Did you guys read the New Portland Monthly? It's crazy.
That's classic, right? That's classic. You know, and when we start comparing, right, it's easy for us to lose sight of the person. And you know, the other person is no longer someone to be known or understood. They're just someone that we want to beat. And they simply become a measuring stick, right, that we're trying to elevate ourselves above. In his letter to the Romans, the Apostle Paul writes about our lens of comparison. And he also reminds us not to see ourselves better than others. This is what he says. He says, by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think of or see yourself more highly than you ought to, but to think or see with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. And what's interesting is he goes on to talk about how important it is that we function like a body together, where everyone has intrinsic value, something to offer, right? And there's no one part of the body that's better than the other. And we're all equally necessary and have the same value. And we're meant to come together, right, with our strengths as well as our weaknesses. And so maybe a question we can ask ourselves, right, is that when we start comparing ourselves to others, like when we go down that path, does it lead us to isolation, where we think we're better and we push people out? Or does it lead us to connection, because we start being curious about differences and what others can teach us? Father Gregory Boyle puts it this way. He says, the measure of our compassion lies not in our service of those on the margins, but in our willingness to see ourselves in kinship. And that means the decided movement towards awe or curiosity and giant steps away from judgment. How can we seek a compassion that can stand in awe or curiosity at what people have to carry rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it? And so for us, you know, maybe something that will help improve our lens of comparison is just to practice curiosity with those that we think we're better than. You know, maybe meet them in person, or at least, you know, have a mental exercise in your mind with them. But hear their story with curiosity. Ask questions that will help you discover areas of their life that can teach you something. And hopefully that will move us more towards connection instead of isolation. And then we close in verse 13. It says, but the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. And here, right, we see a very different prayer than the one the Pharisee gave. Right, it's short, simple, to the point. It's actually a callback to Psalm 51, right? When David was asking for mercy in his moment of desperation. And this prayer embodies the desperation of this tax collector. Right? There's no mention of him changing or making a promise that he'll live differently or that he's going to quit his corrupt job. There's only an acknowledgement that he hasn't lived the way God intended. And now he's relying completely on the mercy of God. And so for us, you know, humility invites us to put on a lens of mercy towards ourselves and others. Because it's just as important to see ourselves with a lens of mercy as it is to see others. You know, if you notice in the story, the tax collector is also standing by himself in isolation. And it's not because he thinks he's better than everyone, like the Pharisee. But for him, he thinks he's unworthy to be present because of how society sees him. He understands that his career choice speaks a lot about his character. And so does he believe that he's worthy of God's mercy? Like, does he believe he can receive God's mercy? I don't know what he's thinking, but what he verbalizes is the hope that God will show him mercy. And all he can do is ask. You know, Father Gregory Boyle, he's a Jesuit priest, and he spent most of his life running, you know, gang intervention programs in L.A. And he's employed many former gang members at Homeboy Industries, which he started. And he does this because he's trying to help them understand and to receive the love that's being offered, right? That regardless of their background, like, he wants to help them understand they're still worthy of receiving love. And so he tells the story of one of these ex-gang members when he was interviewed by Krista Tippett. So here's a clip of that story.
Yeah, and so you're trying to imitate the kind of God you believe in. You want to move away from whatever is tiny-spirited and judgmental, as I mentioned, but you want to be as spacious as you can be, that you can have room for stuff. And love is all there is, and love is all you are, you know. And you want people to recognize the truth of who they are, that they're exactly what God had in mind when God made them. Like, I have a homie named Louie who's just turned 18, and he's kind of a difficult kid. You know, he's exasperating, and he's whiny, and he works for me, although work may be too strong a verb, but homies lately have asked me for blessings, and which is odd. It's like in the last 3 years, and they always ask me on the street or in my office, and they never say, Father, may I have your blessing? They always say, AG, give me a bless, yeah. And they always say it the same way. So this kid, Louie, I'm talking to him, and he's complaining about something, and finally at the end of it, he says, AG, give me a bless, yeah. I said, sure. So he comes around to my side of the desk, and he knows the drill, and he bows his head, and I put my hands on his shoulder. And well, his birthday had been 2 days before, so it gave me an opportunity to say something to him. And I said, you know, Louie, I'm proud to know you, and my life is richer because you came into it. And when you were born, you know, the world became a better place. And I'm proud to call you my son. Even though, and I don't know why I decided to add this part, at times you can really be a huge pain in the ass. And he looks up at you and smiles. He says, the feeling's mutual.
All right, that's that's beautiful, right? That's beautiful. And he's trying to help them understand, right, that even with their background and their shortcomings, right, they're still worthy of God's love and mercy. They've always been and they always will be worthy. This is how he puts it. He says, you know, there's a wideness in God's mercy. In order to experience this mercy and love, we need to accept that there is room for us in it. God loves us whole and entire. This can only come when I know that I'm accepted, especially at my worst. And I think sometimes we just need to hear that over and over and be reminded again and again, right, that we are worthy of God's mercy, no matter what state we're in. And that's how Jesus summarizes what mercy is at the end of this story. Right? He says that everyone who exalts themselves will be humbled. Everyone who humbles themselves will be exalted. Right? Anyone who's high will be brought down. Everyone who's low will be lifted up to where they're on the same level. And that's what mercy is. Mercy is creating the same level of worth and value for everyone. Right? The value that's been given to us by God. And Jesus makes it clear that God's mercy is for everyone because he sees everyone the same. There's no contempt. There's no comparison in God's lens. And so as we close this morning, I want to read one of Vox's values, which is a posture of humility. And, you know, this is our attempt to capture our hope and vision for our community to be shaped by humility. And this is how we describe it. God gives grace to the humble, and a posture of humility emerges as we receive grace in community. Jesus, though equal with God, emptied himself of power and made himself human. We are called to a deep acceptance of this messy humanity, both ours and others, just as Jesus practiced. We have God's DNA, yet live within our shadow, ashamed to live the fullness of God's vision for our lives. Humility is choosing to see ourselves and others more accurately, both our light and darkness. Each person has profound intrinsic worth and carries God's spark. We will work to consider others in addition to ourselves, recognizing that caring only for ourselves is just as damaging as neglecting ourselves, which leads to another form of self-centered living. And that's our hope for us as a community, to carry and hold the posture of humility with ourselves, with others, with God. And so we ask all this in the mercy of the Father, the compassion of the Son, and the vision of the Holy Spirit. Amen.